Good morning. Hope everyone can hear me. I also hope that at least a couple of people here have their coffee mugs with them, because we will need it as an essential ingredient. I also brought my own, so if you are in lack of a coffee mug, I have one here. So just wanted to introduce myself quickly. So what I'm going to talk about today is theory. So we have in our group a couple theory students. We try to understand amorphous systems, both at rest and in the dynamical state. Sort of my day job is get interesting granular experiments and others airborne. We have access to a drop tower. We have a sounding rocket. We do go on parabolic flights. So if you propose a good enough experiment, I'm happy to carry you and also your experiment along. Let's see if that works. I can show you my first little demo. I thought I should go a little lightly after we had a week of extensive and intensive discussions during the talks. So I'll hand that around so that at least some of you are busy and don't stop criticizing me. Here's how I make a soap bubble for you. And one of the things you should look at in the soap bubble is what you also see in that first picture. Here on Earth, all the water is draining down on that soap bubble. So fluctuations on that soap bubble typically induce that the soap bubble would break on the very top. I'm not sure if I have started that. So you see the soap bubble experiences some fluctuation, and it's an actual field of research to understand what processes drive the breakup of a soap bubble. If you have more than just one soap bubble.
Matthias, what are we supposed to do with this?
What you're supposed to do is blow.
Yeah, we don't have
Ah!
Very good.
Yeah, I was worried about Ebola.
Yeah. Pick one.
Great.
So what you're supposed to see is that here on Earth, the water mixture is not symmetric around the soap bubble. If you have more than just a single soap bubble, what you see down here is just a little syringe. This is an experiment you can do easily in your lab. Take syringe, take water, and take air, and shake it, and you will see that your foam that you can create in your syringe only takes half a second to coalesce, go weary. And up here is my first granular experiment done with ellipsoidal particles. I was mandated not to name the brand name of these little critters, but they are the same that were also used in a packing experiment. So if you do that experiment up on the space station, what you see here is a world record, rather a universe record. This is the thickest soap bubble in the world. It contains, in the end, about 10 milliliters of soap solution.
How thick is it?
Well, that amounts to a millimeter or so in thickness. Looks like a glassy, squishy mass. And 10 millimeters in the European Columbus module is sizable to worry about. So this is not what you typically want to have flying around. We were nevertheless able to do that. And we also can use the soap bubble as a nice carrier for what you see here. It's nice and funny, but it also shows the Marangoni convection of a food coloring on top of another surface tension liquid. You cannot do that here. Yeah? So always the color would sink to the bottom and ruin your carpet.
So are those circular domains that are moving around?
Well, we don't do a well-controlled experiment here. We're just putting, so that's basically water and some sugary dye that we have here. So yeah, I would assume it's trying to be circular, but we're not taking extra care of doing that. Yeah. Now shifting gears a little bit. Do we have a pointer here?
It's a laser.
That's the laser pointer? Ah, yeah. Okay. So after that sort of experimental prologue, I want to go through what I planned for you today. I have half an hour, something total.
No.
You take care.
No,
okay. So I will first tell you about some pretty old and established stuff. Here, extending that to driven granular fluids is something very recent, which we are just in the process of testing in numerical simulations. And the discussion about higher order bifurcations I selected for today because it's sort of the most non-trivial, the easiest to be wrong prediction of the theory I will present to you. And I will show you about these higher order singularities in attractive systems, in repulsive systems, and in binary mixtures, and all three of them can be tested both experimentally and in simulation. And if I have time, I will show you that this scenario is probably applicable also to a non-film system. Okay, if you look at dense fluids, one of the things you realize that they are difficult. Maxwell, early enough, said they are not that difficult. Every liquid is as well as a solid and vice versa. It's just a matter of time scale. Landau later on said there is never a chance to do an actual theory for a liquid because there is no small parameter. I can give you the actual reference. It's in one of the issues of the Landau-Lifschitz course of lectures. It's a very negative comment on all the people working in that field, actually. Very nice phrasing of the same problem is attributed to Dorfman by Zwanzig, that all relevant fluxes are non-analytic functions of all relevant variables.
What so you does that mean? Yeah.
Pardon me?
What does that mean?
That basically means everything interesting cannot be calculated.
Give an example, because I think of liquids as a phase, and everything's analytic inside a phase.
Well, if you
change the variables.
Well, here is if you go start from the Boltzmann idealized gas, you calculate the contact value. You took Boltzmann Enskog theory.
Change the temperature, the thermal conductivity changes smoothly and analytically.
What this means is that there's no thermal conductivity.
Yeah. So if you calculate, if you calculate in an expansion in density for higher and higher densities, you have often pretty limited radius of convergence.
You're trying to do perturbation theory in the density or something like
that. Well, if you do perturbation, you may end up having radius of convergence stopping you from doing calculation before it's interesting.
Fine. But that doesn't mean the liquid's properties are not.
It's a statement about kinetic theory.
It's a statement about kinetic theory. Yes.
Would it be more appropriate to say
kinetic theory? You're not talking about the liquid, you're talking about kinetic theory. Thank you.
Yes.
Fine.
Good.
Are we on the same page?
Yep.
Charles.
Yeah, but the previous one about was about liquid, so it was a little bit confusing.
No, got it.
Good.
That's good. But is it more like a distinction between analyticity and being able to find a closed form?
No. It's just a statement about kinetic theory.
Yeah, the expansion can be.
Elastic theory has zero radius of convergence, too.
Yeah.
If you treat it as a perturbation theory in the.
I'm also not saying this is the end of the story. This is the beginning of the talk.
Are you agreeing with these comments? I don't understand why you. Are you putting up to show how wrong these people could be?
No, I'm just motivating that you want to do something different than perturbation theory starting from an ideal gas. Yeah?
Good.
Yeah? Yeah. Also to excuse myself and a number of people in the room that we are less strict in our approach than probably people who are doing other fields in theory. Yeah? You had a question? No?
Okay.
Man, I never had a discussion about that transparency. Okay, so there are a number of reasons to assume that for dense liquids to do a theory properly is difficult. Now I want to mention one other example, or one example where it works. If you have the liquid wafer critical point, there something happens. So we have a very old and paradigmatic equation in theory by van der Waals, fixed a little bit by Maxwell, and then we find that we have a critical point. And at the critical point, you can use the very existence of the critical point to do calculations, starting at the critical point, scaling to it, and calculate basically everything. Yeah, because you have a small parameter. This is what Landau refused to accept in that quote. And with that small parameter, you're able to do calculations. Now, one of the most interesting things is that exponents in such a critical point, and van der Waals produced the paradigmatic mean field theory, where the exponents are all known and very simple. And here, that one, if you look at the critical point, that's how the density jump grows. It grows with the square root. What was found later is that the divergent correlation length in that problem basically invalidates that simple picture. The fluctuations are important, and to cut a long story short, if you include them, you can predict better exponents, which was as an example done by these two fellows. So the bottom line here is, if you have an exceptional point, something exploding, something very special, you don't have to look at the microscopic details anymore, and you can do, in fact, do calculations. So what if you're away from such a liquid gas critical point? You may not be able to do good calculations straightforwardly, but you can always reformulate things. And this is a theory talk, so I need some definitions. So I have a system of n particles, I have a Hamiltonian, including the potential here. And for the time being, I assume it's a Newtonian system. I can do the same thing for a Smoluchowski equation. I define the particle density fluctuations like this. The dynamics is governed by a Liouville equation, where we look at the dynamics of a variable, in that case, at the density. This formalism naturally gives you the correlation functions, and these are the animals that have been used in liquid state theory over the last 50 years at least. Now, if I remember the green Hubo formalism, I can, in linear response, define transport properties from the correlation functions. That's an exact statement. And for these density-density correlation functions, I can see that the long-time limit of such a correlation function gives me an indication if I have an ergodic fluid or if I have a non-ergodic system, and I call this a glass. Yeah? So this is my definition of a glass. And if you look at the time correlation function for a glass system, I use the appropriate logarithmic scale. Here is, just to show an example, an exponential decay, which would be liquid-like. And if I develop a persistent part here, which is the F, then I can speak of a glass, and it's the same in frequency space if that's your measurement. Now, at that point, we're still stuck with Landau's objection. We still don't have a small parameter, and at this point, we need some ansatz or approximation. This may well be looking at the actual physics, looking at the simulation, and find out that something like shear transformation zones or another process seems to be the governing dynamics, and then working out a theory based on that. I'm not using that ansatz directly. I'm using an approximation. I can still express everything exactly in an integral differential equation, which is basically an equation of motion for the correlation functions. And everything is now hidden in that memory kernel, so I need to find a way to get rid of that.
So I just lost the notation. Phi q is the correlation function of rho with rho.
Yeah.
Fourier transform.
Yeah.
Got it.
I do some normalization, which is the static structure factor. Yeah. So I start at one later on. Yeah. But this is still exact. I can write that down and I can calculate all these little prefactors. This is kinetic theory, integrals back and forth. Are you okay?
Can you go back again?
Okay. Oops, that's forward. So I define my dynamic variables here. And what is the Newton equation for that variable? Ends up being the Liouville equation for the correlation function. Yeah? This is my definition for later on convincing you that I'm not introducing the definition of a glass later. I can reformulate that. You may know the continued fraction if you do, in addition to the Fourier transform in space, also a Laplace transform in dynamics. You can write down everything in a continued fraction approach. And you can cut that continued fraction, which amounts to neglecting or setting to zero one of the memory kernels at a certain step. Yeah?
With the truncation of the continued fraction?
Yeah. So this is a reformulation which makes itself more amenable to an approximation or not.
Yeah? What are the entries in the continued fraction?
What do you mean, the entries? So the.
You can write the memory function as a continued. It's this memory function formula, so you can write that.
Yeah. So what you basically do is you can create higher and higher differential terms and get more and more meaningless memory terms here. And you can go ad infinitum, or you can truncate it at some point. And another way of doing it is find out that these memory terms at every step have some physical meaning. So you start with the density, you get as a next step the currents. If you have two steps, you get a memory function that expresses the fluctuating forces. So I do a two-step continued fraction expansion, and I find that I want to deal with that memory term here. And one of the things you can do right or wrong at this point is that you approximate a thing that you should not approximate. Yeah. For example, if you want to find or not rule out a solution where this is finite, you better not approximate in the process something that's zero, because if you approximate a zero, it's probably no longer a zero. Okay. So this is the sort of mathematics you want to respect, and this is also the key insight. If you want to allow that those correlation functions stay slow, you also want to allow that the force fluctuations can also stay slow. Yeah? Other way of saying it is that if you're sitting in there as a red particle, you're trapped by the force producing blue particles, and only if you allow both of them to become slow, then you can close the theory without ruining the possibility of becoming slow. This is sort of formalized here by making the ansatz that the memory term is given as a polynomial, as a functional of the original density fluctuation. So you say the density fluctuation here is given by that equation, and that cage, that memory here, is also given by the density fluctuations of the original particles.
Can I understand you to be saying that mode coupling theory has limitations?
Pardon me? Yeah.
Is that essentially what I should understand from you?
So this is how the approximation is motivated, so to say. Yeah?
I think he's shifted gears. Before he was saying ordinary perturbation theory had limitations. Now he's saying mode coupling theory, although approximate, is actually what he likes.
Well, is that what you're going to do, or are you going to also point out that mode coupling theory has its problems?
It has limitations, because it's only one way of doing things.
Yeah. Yeah? But the excuse is that the other theories are even worse.
Okay.
The other theory that he talked about.
Right. Oh, sorry.
Well, I think we agree there's no way of doing it exact for the time being with kinetic theory to solve everything.
Yes, with kinetic theory.
Yeah.
So this looks linear, but you're saying the M is having all the nonlinearities. Is that correct?
Yeah. Okay. So I'm doing that approximation, and like for another ansatz, I cannot argue. I can argue why this is a sensible thing to do, but this is not perturbative. I cannot write down readily the next term, so we need to see what comes out, and we may be able to describe some things, and we may be able to not be able to describe some things. Yeah?
So usually M would involve even higher order correlations or something like that, and you're just and to truncate, you need to have a closure approximation. This is your closure.
Yeah. I can either set that to zero, which is the simplest approximation, then I have a damped harmonic oscillator, which describes many neutron scattering experiments already.
That's what he's saying by this picture here, is that in order for the red circle to move out of its cage, a bunch of other particles have to cooperate.
In a sense, that's a caricature of what I do here mathematically.
Rather than truncate, could you just make an approximation
that
would keep every term in the continued fraction, but just in a, let's say, an assuming...
sum an infinite number of diagrams.
Well, you can do it in a continued fraction. You can often
I'm not complaining.
You have reformulated that, and then you need to do something. Otherwise, you can only make statements. Yeah?
Maybe we should let them go.
So you can approximate that with one exponential. You can put exponentials in here. You can go three steps on. The problem is the further you go down in your continued fraction, the more prefactors you gather up, and you're ending up with lesser and lesser measurable or intuitive quantities. Yeah? So in a sense, not truncating, but approximating after the second step is the simplest you can do.
So it is true that to cross the phase boundary, most field theory people think that they can't do perturbation theory, but they only can do perturbation theory, so they sum an infinite number of diagrams, and that gives them an approximate but infinite number of diagrams, and that gives them a caricature of the critical point. And it's not obvious whether by truncating to third order you're allowed to have a critical point now, or whether you would really need to go to all orders in your continued fraction in order to get a critical point. It's an interesting question.
Yeah, so this is not clear, but I'll tell you how this works if I do it like that.
If you make this approximation, then you see a transition. And it looks like a glass transition.
And I show you exactly how that transition comes about, because it's different from a critical point.
I grasped on this in the experiment, in the simulation, was that is a take of the Moskowitz theory. And if we go beyond the transition approximation by using the Bode diagram, because we can reproduce the same result by based on the field theory. And if we go beyond the Moskowitz theory, we can get divergence in the calculation. So divergence, so that
divergence,
becomes negative.
It's not clear if it's getting better if you do it more fancy. Yeah, it's a non-perturbative way.
It's a field theory Feynman diagram approach that gives the same kind of answer.
Yeah, yeah. And when you read in the past approximation, that it's very hard to obtain the next order regularized result. No.
The answer is you need different physics.
There was another question or comment?
Just to comment on that, maybe another way of presenting the same equations is to say that they can be obtained essentially as one loop approximation in non-linear fluctuating hydrodynamic equations. And you get essentially the same mathematical structure. So it is non-perturbative, and it has
as a history, in the ancient days, when this was all very exciting and new, John Toner gave a talk. And he managed to distill this basic idea into the simplest form where it was a one particle in a well, and it had a barrier, and he showed that it couldn't leave the well because of some low coupling calculation with the self-consistent approximation. And of course, when he started giving the talk, we pointed out to him that of course you could prove that it does leave the well, and he then gave up on low coupling theory. So there's a sense in which this phase transition that you get out of low coupling theory is a self-consistent answer with an approximation which at least you need to know that it may not be true, because there is a sense in which some systems cannot have phase transitions, but in mode coupling theory they can appear to.
I think we should let you go on.
That's the reason why I put all the ancient stuff on there. To make that precise, not every approximation is useful for every problem. You cannot just approximate everything by the same thing. So this is what we're doing. Yeah? And it has a physical rationalization.
Yep.
It doesn't ruin many properties you want from correlation functions, which is a non-trivial thing. Don't generate negative spectra and stupid thing like that. And in the end, but that's the grad student's task, you need to calculate all these little prefactors, and it turns out that you can basically just take the static structure as an input and get the answer to the dynamical problem. Now, you can prove, if you look at the equations, that you only have a single critical dimension, which is another word to say that I can basically map all that complicated integrals into one-dimensional polynomials. Okay. So this is the vertex function I showed you. This is basically the approximated version of the memory kernel. And that memory kernel, like I did it here, is a polynomial. Now, the interesting question, if you remember three slides back, is can I have a theory that produces a finite correlation function in the end, or can I not? Now, the solutions I get always have a zero, so the liquid is a solution to my equations, so I'm probably not totally stupid. And if I look at the caricature of my polynomial, if I change density or temperature, I can create a quadratic zero here going through the horizontal. So this is the point where my equation produces a finite persistent correlation function. And in the Green-Kubo sense, we agreed, or I dogmatically stated, that this is one version of defining a glass transition. Okay? So this was discovered in 1984, so I have nothing to do with that. I entered preschool at that point. So this was not doctored by me, but discovered by these gentlemen. So in a sense, this signals the end of the liquid regime. You set out to describe a liquid, and you find a singularity where suddenly your liquid develops a persistent part, or if you're a scattering person, a quasi-elastic line in the spectrum. And this singularity gives you a small parameter, and with that you can then calculate asymptotic solutions, scaling functions, and all that. And I'm happy to tell you all that, but you can also read that in a recent book and in all the publications. You can also trust us that we can do the algebra. Yeah? So if you don't like the theory, you have to do it here, because the rest is again except. Yeah? So up to here, the derivation is rigorous. This is the ansatz. This ansatz allows us to find that singularity, and the rest, again, is just calculation. Yeah? Don't hate me for the wrong point. So here is where our coffee mug comes in. So you could see that what I showed you here is just simple 10th grade mathematics. If you change the parameter, you create a double zero, and you qualitatively change from no solution to a double solution to two solutions. You can also prove within the theory that only the highest singularity is assumed by your equations. It's not a physical statement. You can prove it mathematically that your dynamic equations always assume the highest F, because you may have many solutions here. But this you can show if you look at the properties of that equation.
So are you going to talk more about the kinds of predictions people can make and can't make?
Yeah.
Okay.
I will focus more on the ones that you can make, naturally.
Okay.
But I'm happy to talk about known limitations.
What is your small parameter in this case?
The small parameter, if you hit that point, is first of all, you're close to that plateau value, to that F. This is a small parameter, and you have a small distance from your critical point. Standard thing, you have a critical point, divergent, whatever. You go to that point and you calculate everything from there, both the Y and the X, basically. So now already in that picture, you see you could go on with that. We know it's always only those kinds of singularities. You could have a cubic, which will turn out to be the endpoint of a glass-glass transition, which I will explain. You can have quartic singularities, which I would assume is the last one where we found a physical interpretation. We have not seen, at least not from more than far, a fifth order singularity. Now here comes your coffee mug, and something I probably need to explain here because it never seems to rain here. So this is the theory of a rainbow. If you have a droplet of water, that impact parameter, this thing basically produces an extremum at the angle where you see for different colors different maximum scattering from that moist air. And this is one of the first discovered fold singularities. I have it from Michael Berry's paper, that this was written down and plotted first by René Descartes ages ago. So you have a singularity, and only in a certain direction you have scattering of light of different colors into your eyes. And if you now take your very own coffee mug, light is coming from here. If you want to look it up, this is a theory of caustics in ray emission. You have a line of folds like this one. This is where light preferentially goes. And if two of those folds meet discontinuously, you have a cusp singularity. So this is nothing out of the ordinary and actually quite nice mathematics. And you're dealing with many folds that have critical singular points. And you can basically look that up in the math book, how you deal with those. Now I show you quickly how the theory works for hard spheres. We have the big plus that we can start with an actual potential because we stick the Hamiltonian in there. We specify the interaction. Not really deus ex machina, but in the end, we find that the vertex doesn't need the bare potential. It needs only sort of a smoothed out version in the static structure factor, which is an animal you know as the Fourier transform of the pair distribution function. You stick that into the theory, and you get forces and densities arrested. And this is sort of the critical amplitudes, or the critical parameter in the theory. If that is zero, you call it a liquid. If you find it's finite, you call it a glass.
Now, back in the olden days, last I heard.
Is the old days 70s or 80s?
Probably.
Well, Fixman was no earlier than late 60s, but anyway.
Pardon, no, this is after Goetze, but before
okay.
you.
So we're not speaking of, let's say, the Kawasaki type.
No.
Okay.
In the olden days of coupling theory for glasses,
okay.
The glass transition that you found, there were lots of things. First of all, you had some connection to the interatomic potential, which was nice. Secondly, you got something that looked like alpha relaxation and beta relaxation. But one of the challenges was that your glass transition appeared to not have the nice, very strongly diverging viscosity. It had power law, and it yep. sort of looked like it was happening much higher temperature than it was supposed to. Is yep. that still true?
Two comments, it's a little more involved. So if we speak of hard spheres,
yep.
you have two approximations that you need to do the calculation. You want to do the mode coupling approximation, you also need a static structure factor.
Yep.
We take run-of-the-mill Perkusiewicz for what we put in, and we basically get, nice question, we get out 52. If you measure
I'm not saying that your prediction for the glass transition.
No, I have a twofold
okay.
answer.
Okay.
Yeah. So, first for the experimentalists, okay. then for the theoreticians, or vice
yep.
versa.
Yep.
So you have Perkusiewicz plus MCT, you get 52. The actual experiment says 58.
Good.
So you need to shift to the critical point, and do your exponents, master functions from there. So I think that's agreed, at least among theoreticians, that this is the right way to do your shift to that. And if you look closer, basically 50% of the blame going to the structure factor, 50% MCT is wrong.
But
still the first
yeah.
part. Yeah. So you're not hitting the numbers accurately, because any approximation you do here in that functional lets you hit that critical point a little off of the supposed actual.
In the olden days,
that's not a critical thing, right?
No. I'm yeah. saying
what
that is. Let me.
Is not the most important.
Yeah. So we are not hitting it dead on in the numbers.
But it's not clear whether that means that you predicted TC wrong, which nobody cares about.
Yeah.
Or if you've got a pretty good theory for weakly supercooled liquids
yeah.
that breaks down at some point where your self-consistent theory
which is actually
like
my second part of the answer.
Yeah. Okay.
So I just wanted to be extra clear what is the problem and what
yep.
so this is not the problem.
Yeah, no, that's not.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah if you can do that better, fine, but if it's.
Yeah, right, who cares? Well,
how many digits in the transition point do you want?
Right.
Yeah? So this is not the point. If you, and I will show you in a slide or two, that this point we can actually describe very well. So now what happens, if you remember three slides back, I said I make an ansatz. This is the point where I basically say, now I can do STC, sorry for hitting on that. Now I need to do something. I need to go home, or I do something that's
what
sort of.
What STZ has to do with more
coupling?
You said STZ?
No, I'm just saying I had two slides back the point where I say now I'm doing something approximate
yeah.
and making an ansatz.
Yeah.
So most likely my ansatz doesn't capture 100% of the processes going on in what I have in front of me. Otherwise, I wouldn't need to make an ansatz or an approximation.
So in the olden days, the ansatz was that once you formed a cage, you couldn't get out, and that was considered the thing that was breaking down.
Yeah.
Is that still true?
I would phrase it a little different. You say, I make an approximation, and the approximation captures, to name a number, 90% of the processes.
Sure.
Yeah. So now I have a singularity. And at the singularity, the transport given by that 90% of processes goes to zero. Yeah, this is the essence of the theory.
Good.
Now, if 90% go to zero, every dirt, which is a word for not covered by my approximation, every dirt shows up, and gives me additional processes that now show up dominantly. If my approximation can do 99%, the 99% go to zero, 1% will stick up. Yeah?
But the diverging viscosity is in that
1%. Now, yeah. If you look at the colloidal systems, you have sort of 5 or 6 decades the theory can describe very well. I show you that very nicely. Yeah. If you bear with me for a second and say that's the 99%, and then is everything else. I did deliberately call it the end of the liquid regime, and then it's getting more complicated. In metallic systems, you would see that this is typically the coincidental with the breakdown of Stokes-Einstein. Yeah? So you see that there is something going on if you leave the liquid, and then you have a couple more decades to be described by something that's better surpassing the theory. But for these colloidal systems, we are pretty good, also because they don't have 16 decades, but 8. Yeah? So this is what I would say is the physical picture. We can basically describe it from the liquid decently a fair number of decades into the solid. And let's say I once did a calculation and looked if you carried the same strictness to define a crystal. If you define a crystal by vanishing diffusion, you never accept that the crystal actually exists because you have enough void diffusion right after the transition that this would not work out with that criterion. Yeah? So in a sense, if you accept that loose defense, there's some processes left over, and people typically call that hopping. This is not captured by that. Yeah, that's the 5% or 1% remaining. And that's particularly visible in the molecular glasses because that's where most people measure, because the actual transition people or glass makers are interested in is not the TC but the TG, which is often 20% different from the TC. Long answer, but that was the second part. First deviation is not a problem. So this is the caricature. The curves are actual calculations. This is the logarithmic axis here, and I show one example for a wave vector's density-density correlation function. One thing the theory describes very nicely is the appearance of such a plateau, which in the scattering function is the alpha peak. Yeah? So that's a non-trivial thing. Where does that finite thing come from? And here in the mean squared displacement, we find that this length scale here is remarkably close to the Lindemann length. So this is an outcome. So we're not numerically too far off. And here the t to the minus a minus t to the b. So this is an asymptotic expansion of the master functions we generate, which I'm happy to talk about, but this is getting us into very technical grounds. Yeah? And again, so that's the caricature is you have cage, and you have rattling in the cage, and you have a critical dynamics just close to the onset of flow. And then when the cage dissolves, you have yet another power law that was measured by the Knight von Schweidler first in the 19th century with a Leyden jar. And you can connect those two power laws with some parameters of the theory and explain that. Now, we start with the simplest system, which is colloidal hard spheres. This is a beautiful picture by Pusey and van Meegen. You see that for lower density, you have the amorphous system, you have the crystal here, and the bluer it gets, the denser you have the liquid, and here is the glass phase. Look at how many decades they can cover with their experiments. So this is 8 decades of non-trivial dynamics, starting from the Brownian motion down here, and you cover a couple decades. So this is not a microscope, but this is extracted from the scattering signal by Van Meegen and company. And you can nicely put on top of the black curves, which is the experiment, the red curves, which is the theory. And you need to make two adjustments. You shift to the critical point, which gives you a linear curve. And nice enough, when you deviate from the linear curve, these are the curves that are affected by aging in the experiment. And given that the experiment then has a different density, you also have to adjust by 20% the height of that plateau. And you have the overall time scale, but that's also trivial. We don't model the chemistry of the solution. So this would be my litmus test to say, for a non-trivial scenario over orders of magnitude, the theory describes 8, 5, whatever you find non-trivial orders of magnitude in the dynamics, and it's little changes in the density that cause orders of magnitude variation in the diffusion up here. I will go beyond that, make things more complicated. I already stated that for molecular glasses, you would like to treat the 1%, 10% hopping processes, which I would say currently nobody can do within that formalism convincingly. Yeah? You can do the same thing as I appealed to in the beginning. You say, now I have one hopping process, barrier hopping, thermally activated, this and that. This has been done, but it's not clear if it captures all of it. 9%, yeah? So there are valid statements about how you can extend certain processes, but it also looks that for certain measurements, the alpha process below TC or beyond the mode coupling transition is different for whatever you measure, which is not surprising. Why should the viscosity be the same as a diffusion? One is a highly collective thing, the other is just a one particle thing. It's rather more surprising that in the liquid, everything's coupled, if you look at it that way. Yeah? So how do we go beyond that? When do we shoot off the podium? In 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. Oh, we are.
You can go a little over.
Okay.
15?
I will just shoot that at you. So this theory has been extended into two dimensions, hard disks, mixtures, short-range attractions. I'll show you in a minute. We have also done ellipsoids and dumbbells. This is sort of an exercise in being able to solve for the equations regarding the static structure factor and the matrix version of that. Well, so if you're interested, I can happily show you additional things about that.
What are you plotting there? I'm not.
This
an aspect ratio of a
this
particle?
Is a screwed up version of the aspect ratio that allows me to make it symmetric between cigar shaped and platelet oplet particles. Yeah? Because one of the findings is that in addition to the transition from an isotropic fluid to a glass, I can, for relatively small aspect ratios, still have the system translationally frozen, but rotationally free. And this is one of the first versions where we find additional transitions to the liquid glass transition. And just as a hint, going back to the candy, both this variation with the maximum at an aspect ratio of 1.5, as well as the freezing in of all the rotational degrees of freedom, are remarkably close in the thermal theory and in the athermal computer experiment. Yeah? So one of the surprising things here is, if you start from 6, which is the spherical limit for the number of contacts, is that you don't immediately jump to 10, which should be the contacts for an aspherical particle. Rather, you go relatively smoothly until you exhaust all the degrees of freedom. And nice enough, that's part of an additional transition that you can calculate from that theory.
But which is, that has to do with counting. The hypostaticity argument of Porter, which says that I don't have to jump to 10, right? has to do with, again, contact. So I don't understand why that has anything to do with glasses.
Well, I would say 10 is counting and 6 is counting.
No, no. Torquato, yes, 10 is counting, but Torquato Art tells you why it goes between 6 and 10.
Yeah.
In that way.
Because you're exhausting rotational degrees of freedom. That's what I learned from the news and views in that nature article.
I'm saying it's not, has nothing to do with glassiness.
I'm not saying it has anything. I'm stating a coincidence that when we are basically exhausting all the degrees of freedom that we need 10 contacts here, this is remarkably similar to an additional transition where the rotational degrees of freedom frees in a glassy fashion in the theory.
Are you saying the mode coupling theory gives you a prediction for contact number?
No, I'm not saying that.
Okay.
I'm stating a coincidence.
Say it again slow. I'm just slow, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So this is the granular experiment or simulation.
We understand the contact number.
So the contact number, rather than jumping, creeps up.
Yes.
And it's exhausting the 10 you want to have for that shape only roughly at 1.5.
And the coincidence is that the glass transition has something.
If you think of it in terms of degrees of freedom, and the rotational degree of freedom is the one that's left over if you're in that regime. Yeah? And if you're blocking, in addition to the translation, the rotation, that can be found as an additional.
You're saying there's a rotational freezing that happens
later
between 1.3 and 1.5.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
In fact, is it? So what I know from looking at ellipses and the glass transition is that it's a question of at which temperature, then this is not thermal, at which temperature the translational degrees of freedom freeze in contrast to the rotational degrees of freedom. And for, I've forgotten which one is which, but the smaller aspect ratios, one happens higher, and then for the larger aspect ratio, the other happens higher. The rotational is freeze before the translational is true, and the translation.
In addition, you have pneumatic order, which also spits.
Forget about that. I'm not talking about order, right? Disordered, but at what temperature the rotational degrees of freedom freeze in compared to the translational degrees of freedom does switch at a particular aspect ratio.
And the suggestion is that that transition is the one you
see? That I don't know. That's what I'm asking. So in thermal things, I would say if I'm on the smaller aspect ratio end, then the translational freezes before the rotation, so you're controlled by that.
Sounds like it's known that there is a transition. It would be much nicer, rather than talking about contact number, to actually tell us whether you capture that transition or not. But maybe we can take that offline.
We can also do that offline, and there are people in the room who don't share my opinion. Currently, I would say MCT cannot do the A-thermal system.
MCT cannot do what?
But she was talking about temperature.
Well, A-thermal means temperature equals zero.
But she was saying.
No, I was talking about a thermal glass transition, a thermal analysis of ellipses.
Yeah.
And we see that if you change the aspect ratio of ellipses, then there is a.
There's a thermodynamic transition for the ellipses, she says. It may be new.
Yeah.
It's not thermodynamic. It's still a glass transition.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
So we have a problem because we have this other talk at 12:15. So I'm suggesting let's have him finish the talk and then offline continue after.
Good. Appreciate the interest, and I'm not running away for the next week, so you will for sure have time to catch me on anything. Okay, I will go through that then briefly. We can do the granular system as well. We are very proud of it because it has a time evolution operator that's time reversal non-translational at the very contact, which makes it difficult because you have to solve all your integrals straightforwardly. You cannot use any symmetries. But we were able to do that, and we find that the glass transition moves to higher densities if you change the dissipation. Now, this is a prediction that can be tested. and it can be wrong. It's done in that collaborative research unit. There are a couple of features from the colloidal and Newtonian glassy dynamics that break down if you do granular glassy dynamics. And if you do the simulation, we find that the mode coupling theory for granular glasses, dissipative and driven, is about the one we measured in the simulation. Now, coming to the actual topic of my talk, where are the higher order singularities? And the basic answer is you need competing mechanisms of arrest. As I showed you in your coffee mug, you want two lines of glass transitions coming together, and there's a possibility that they do that discontinuously, and then you have a glass to glass transition. That has been done 10 years ago for a glass that has an attractive well, so you can basically form gels by bond formation, and you have the regular hard sphere glass transition. These two lines can come together smoothly. They can come.
Gamma is?
Gamma is the depth of the potential.
Oh, okay.
So we have the density from the hard spheres, we have the depth and the width of the potential. So these are three cuts of the overall transition diagram, and we go from what everyone expected. You can cool it or you can compress it and form a glass. We have the fancy reentrance phenomenon I'm happy to tell you about. And you can go from a gel to a hard sphere glass discontinuously or around such fancy singularities. The interesting thing is that we can crank the machine and calculate a whole lot for the dynamics that you would expect in every point here. So the theory may be complicated, but it makes specific predictions that you can test. Yeah? And then it's not always easy to say, did I screw up my simulation? Do I measure at a different point? Or is it really a test that the theory is wrong here? But this is what people have done very, very much in detail. So this is a very extended molecular dynamics simulation in Francesco Schottino's group. And if you just remember the hard sphere case, where for 5 decades you nicely saw a plateau, here you have glassy dynamics over 8 decades and you don't see a plateau, which is actually consistent with the theory that for such higher order singularities you have different solutions in your equations of motion. And you can calculate all these little parameters and they're always 20-30% wrong, but this is where the controversy then starts. You say, do I accept that because the overall picture is okay, or do I not like that because mode coupling predicts a higher order singularity and then the location is 50% wrong? So you can always nicely disagree. This is an experiment for that same thing. Here is the liquid regime. Here is the gel regime, labeled red, and the hard sphere-like regime. So there is some transition also visible in the experiments. We've done that a couple of years ago for a repulsive system. The surprise is that what we expected was either that or this, and it turns out, no, there's something with two endpoints, which you find out from the theory later why that is. So you have a liquid glass transition, and within the glass you can trigger sort of a stiffening transition. You get much higher shear modulus. Pardon me?
Go back. What's the difference between the figure A and B?
Figure A is a width of 13% and that's 15%. So you have an additional line of glass-glass transitions that basically overtakes the regular liquid-glass transition if you go further. And this again has quite detailed dynamic predictions here. You have a glass transition, a glass-glass transition, a higher order singularity, a crossing. So this is so complicated you couldn't make that up if you wanted to. So we can argue that sort of the beating, which is the two length scales competing, produces such a feature in the static structure factor. and it's switching on and off this weight in the functionals that produces the glass-glass transition. And only if the two length scales are both important, you can have a glass-glass transition. So that rationalizes the two endpoints. Ha! Detailed predictions, detailed measurements. You again see that's 8 orders of magnitudes, glassy dynamics, and no plateau. Yeah? So this is again logarithmic dynamics. And we have tons of other data. So this is the beating we found in the structure factor in the simulation. And this is the original MCT line. And this is the mapped out version of that MCT line after you do tons of simulations for that square shoulder potential. There's a nice aspect I cannot go into. There's also glass-glass transitions. If you look at binary mixtures, you can have a glass driven by the small particles, you can have it driven by the large particles and the transitions between that. And there may even be an analog of that in the packings, but let me conclude here. So what can you use those higher order singularities for? They are highly non-trivial predictions of at least one glass transition theory. There are others in replica symmetry framework where people try to do that as well. Maybe those states are useful. Yeah, so add only a little bit of additive to your mayonnaise or your colloidal gel and make it much stiffer. That's something the food industry is interested in. And maybe such bifurcation scenarios are an alternate way or an additional way of detecting additional transitions in granular packings. And now I'm happy to leave you either to your lunch or to grill me if that's your better lunch. Thank you much.
I think we can take just a couple more questions. Yeah. So this beating of length scales, I mean, that's in spatial expanse. That should be visible in any experiment, right?
I'm not sure what
the last, just if you go back one slide, or two slides.
Two slides?
Huh? That's different.
You're talking about the binary mixtures.
Yeah, just you had the structure fracture with the beating length scales.
Yeah.
Okay.
This one.
Yeah, so so the left hand side,
yep,
at the bottom. That is so the vertical axis is the structure factor, the horizontal axis is
the wave vector, yes.
Right, so sigma is
1, so that's the diameter of the particles.
Okay. So that's something that is an experimental or simulation observable.
Yes, but I would rather do it in simulation because that's the peak of the structure factor. So a scattering experiment would mostly die here because of the form factor. Yes, in a direct imaging you may be able to go beyond that, but so this is reasonably
short distance structure.
What did I say?
This is structure on length scale, yeah, yeah, smaller, yeah, than an atom.
The particle.
Yeah. So how do you want to measure that?
Mm. That's not good.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Okay.
That's what I wanted to make sure I understood that.
Yeah.
Good point.
But this is a simulation. So we saw it in the simulation,
right,
here.
But you have an unmeasurable prediction.
Well, in the simulation.
You don't know what you get.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's clear, let's say, this is just a Fourier transform. This is a two-line hand calculation. You don't need to confirm that. When once you know that you have those two length scales in the problem, you have one hardcore, you have another hardcore, you can calculate that beating in two lines of algebra. Yeah,
and
it's nice that it is there, but I would seriously doubt the simulation if it were not there. Yeah, this is just a Fourier transform,
okay,
and the beating, you can write that down very easily. But it's nice that it is there because it identifies that you're in the right regime where we consistently expect from that beating all those complicated predictions.
All right. No more questions. Then I would say let's break for lunch. And at 12:15 in here is the lunch colloquium, the next talk. Okay. Let's thank him again for our session.